Everyone, and welcome back to the Epstein Chronicles. Today is the 14th day of the Ghislaine Maxwell trial, and we are kind of in a holding pattern as we await on the defense to begin making their case starting Thursday. So what we're going to do is continue to fill in some of those blanks. Now, when we talk about Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell, you cannot talk about these people without talking about how they used class warfare, basically, on poor people. Now, when I say that, I mean they chose people who came from poor and broken homes, people who only had one parent in their home, people who have been abused, whatever it may be. These were the people that Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell targeted on a daily basis. And when you look at one of their main centers of operation, which was Palm Beach, the discrepancy between wealth a mere 5 or 6 miles away between West Palm Beach and Palm Beach is mind-boggling. Now, I live in Las Vegas, so I see this all the time. You live in a place like Las Vegas, and you look at Las Vegas Boulevard, all of the money, all of the wealth, all of the prestige. You take a quick drive 2 miles east, 1 mile east, into East Las Vegas, into Central Las Vegas, and you see right away how different of a story it is. Homeless camps, people struggling, daily, weekly apartments, the whole flip. And you can see how there's almost an invisible line from where the wealth ends and the misery begins. And I'm sure most of you, wherever you're from, if you're from a big city, you have areas like this as well. I watched a documentary about kids in Orange County, California, and it broke my heart. These kids lived across the street from Disneyland in these hotels. And obviously, their parents never had the money to bring them to Disneyland. So these kids every night would watch the fireworks, go over into the parking lots, hang out in the parking garage, but they never had a chance to actually go into the park. And it's a microcosm of how society is in general at this point. There are those who have, and then there's the rest of us. And when I talk about the discrepancy in wealth, I'm not talking about, your buddy Joe who went to school and worked his way up and earning a great living now. I'm talking about generational wealth. I'm talking about wealth that most of us will never even be able to comprehend. And that's the kind of wealth that Maxwell and Epstein came from. Maxwell especially. Epstein by proxy, but Maxwell was born into this. Her father, Robert Maxwell, super rich guy. What do you think? They were sitting around talking well of poor people? Of course they weren't. So Ghislaine Maxwell has always been one of these upper crust types who looks down her nose at the rest of us. And all you have to do, again, is listen to the survivors themselves. Cut out the middlemen. You really need some jerk off from the New York Times to tell you the deal when the survivors are telling you the story themselves? Ghislaine Maxwell had a pretty shitty opinion of people who were poor. Ghislaine Maxwell, according to all of these allegations and to what a lot of these survivors have said, had nothing good to say about people who were poor. And when you add all of that up and you look at the people that they targeted, it's rather obvious what was going on here. It's rather obvious that Ghislaine Maxwell and Jeffrey Epstein weren't doing this on a whim. This was planned out. This was plotted out. And we go back to New Mexico once again because it's the elephant in the room. He chose New Mexico for a reason. He knew that he could take these girls there and look at little penalty, little to no penalty, in fact, for abusing them. Oh, well, 16's the age of consent. They consented. Says you. And of course, who was brought to Zorro Ranch? Who was brought to the Manhattan townhouse? Who was brought down to Palm Beach or the Virgin Islands. Girls from broken homes, girls who were poor, and girls that Maxwell and Epstein looked at as less than. And that's just the fact of the situation. That's how they looked at people, looked at us, everybody. But these girls specifically, there were nothing more to them than a thing to be traded, a commodity. And we all know that that's not how things should be. No human being should ever be put into any kind of servitude or thought that they have to use their body to get by. It's not how this is supposed to work. And then the fact that this guy and Maxwell and the rest of these scumbags got away with it for so long, with so many girls coming out and telling their story, is just beyond the pale. But when you look at the overall picture here, and you look at the MO between Epstein and Maxwell and their criminal enterprise, it was always the same kind of girls who were targeted, poor and from the other side of the tracks. This morning, we're going to touch on an article from Financial Times that kind of goes into this a little bit. And we're going to see what they have to say about it. This article was authored by Joshua Chaffin. On the eighth day of the government sex trafficking case against Ghislaine Maxwell, a prosecutor asked a witness, known as Sean, what the difference was between Palm Beach and West Palm Beach, two Florida towns separated by a drawbridge. Money's no object over there, said Sean, a West Palm Beach native, sounding as though the nearby island were a different planet. Growing up, he told the jury, he had very rarely even ventured into Palm Beach because I didn't have enough money to buy anything in the gas station. That changed, he said, when he began ferrying his 14-year-old girlfriend to the island to provide sexualized massages for Jeffrey Epstein. Soon, they were struggling to find a store to change the bills in West Palm Beach, where they don't accept $100 bills, Sean explained. That's something you'll see in a lot of poorer neighborhoods for sure. The fact that they're not going to accept those $100 bills. You better come with something smaller for sure. And according to Sean, he went from not being able to afford anything in the gas station to having all these $100 bills after bringing Carolyn, his girlfriend, over for sexualized massages at Jeffrey Epstein's house. Class is threaded throughout the Epstein story. Maxwell, an Oxford-educated product of fee-paying British public schools, used hers to smooth the social path of the Coney Island-born Epstein when they joined forces in the early 1990s Manhattan. Now, class is present in Maxwell's criminal trial, too. It loomed as witnesses recounted over the last 2 weeks how a tall British woman, with what one called a proper English accent, lured them when they were young and poor into a world beyond their imagination. So you get the idea here where he's going in the article. And the fact of the matter is, this is exactly what happened. Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell chose these young girls from these broken homes because they knew that they'd be able to get away with it, or that it would be more likely that they'd be able to get away with it. So, they went on their spree. And you want to talk about the early 90s, we can go back a little bit earlier even. Jeffrey Epstein, look, this isn't something that just happens overnight. You don't wake up one morning and have a broken brain like this dude and think trafficking little girls is a good idea. You came off the assembly line fucked up. You're a lemon. There ain't no fixing you. It doesn't matter what mechanic we bring you to. Nobody's fixing you, bro. People like this need to be put underneath the jail. The author goes on in the article to say, it sounded practically like a Dickinson novel when one of Maxwell's accusers described how Epstein had sent a chauffeur-driven car to bring her and her mother across the bridge for tea at his Palm Beach mansion. The girl was 14 at the time, and her father had died months earlier, bankrupting the family, she said. After offering himself as her patron, Epstein would go on to abuse the girl for years, she testified. Maxwell helped, she said, by winning her confidence and gradually pushing her boundaries. Maxwell would help normalize all of it. That was her role. Maxwell was the one to make these girls feel comfortable. The one where, you know, if you're one of these girls, you'd say to yourself, oh, this lady with this posh accent, this is never going to happen to me. I'm never going to get abused when I'm in the company of somebody like Ghislaine Maxwell. And then all of that is flipped on its head. Everything that these girls thought was going to be the case turned out to be something completely different. And then the whole, well, why do they keep going back? You got to get deeper into the nuance of it all, my friend. People who have that kind of commentary don't really understand what goes on here and the psyche behind all of it. There is so much that goes on as far as the gaslighting, Stockholm syndrome, the grooming, the normalization of it all. It's just absurd how much goes into it. But it's effective. When these people get their hooks into somebody, it's almost impossible to get them out. When you normalize this kind of weird-ass, weirdo behavior, when kids are young and their brains are still developing, it's a whole lot easier to get them involved, to have them as part of the operation, right? Send them out to bring in other girls because you've normalized it to them. So in their brains, they say, well, this is normal behavior. Maybe my friends want to make some money. And it goes on and on and on. And remember, it couldn't have happened if it was just Epstein. Some creepy-ass, old-looking weirdo. He had to have all of these other moving parts. The Ghislaine Maxwells. The Sarah Kellen Vickers. The Leslie Groffs. The Adriana Rosses. And you look at Nadia Marchenkova, her situation, her being, you know, given to Jeffrey Epstein as a 15-year-old to be groomed and molded to what he wants. That's a whole different kind of disgusting, draconian sadness. But Epstein couldn't have done this in a vacuum. He couldn't have done this without the help of somebody like Ghislaine Maxwell. The article goes on to say, Maxwell denies this and other suggestions of wrongdoing. Her attorneys insist she has been made a scapegoat for the sins of Epstein, who died by suicide, allegedly, in a New York prison cell a month after he was arrested in 2019. So that is the premise for her defense. There's no doubt about it. Let's try and destroy the credibility of the survivors and accusers. And let's make sure we pin this all on Epstein, because there's no way Ghislaine Maxwell could have been involved in this, right? No way at all. But yet here we are once again with another story about Ghislaine Maxwell, with more witness testimony about Ghislaine Maxwell. And while it is a not unexpected move on the part of the defense to try and make it all about Epstein, the fact of the matter is this. Ghislaine Maxwell was present. Ghislaine Maxwell was actively participating according to the allegations. And this is not about Jeffrey Epstein. This is about Ghislaine Maxwell. They have also tried to use class to their advantage during the trial. In her opening statement, attorney Bobby Sternum claimed the accusers were money grabbers who had twisted the truth in hopes of financial jackpot. It was reminiscent of political strategist James Carville dismissing former President Clinton's sexual accusers in 1994 by remarking, drag a $100 bill through a trailer park, you never know what you'll find. Yeah, remember that, James Carville? Mr. Big Time, big shot over there under the umbrella? That's how they feel about you, all of them. Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, they don't think they care about you. They think that if they drag a $100 bill through a trailer park, that maybe, you know, one of your family members will bite. Maybe they can bring one of your family members into the fold. Bunch of sick bastards with comments like that. And still, somebody who's running around on TV, right? Where's his cancel culture moment? Yeah, don't worry, I won't hold my breath either. It is not clear whether class issues will sway the jury of mostly working-class New Yorkers who will decide the fate of a British socialite or, you know, co-conspirator, general all-around scuzzbag, fellow child abuser, and bipedal serpent. Throughout the trial, prosecutors have shown them photos of Epstein's private jets and opulent properties in New York, New Mexico, the Caribbean, and Palm Beach, where the bathroom had a sofa. Oh, well, bathroom had a sofa, so there's that. As a gossip columnist in Palm Beach, Jose Lambiet developed a jaded view about the divide between Palm Beach, a manicured bunker of old money, and West Palm Beach, a place that was originally built to house the help and long suffered from a reputation of drugs and violence. Well, that's how it always goes, right? You build a shanty town for the hired help, and then, you know, let's treat them like shit, let them live in weeklies, whatever it may be. But as long as the stench isn't permeating over there into Palm Beach, where you got all that beautiful money, right? Where people like Trump and Epstein are hanging out. Can't have it over there. Keep that shit 6 miles away. No gentrification projects. None of these big shot loudmouths who live in the area stepping up to help the community. Like usual, just take, 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 and take. And at the same time, if we abuse some poor kids along the way, who gives a fuck? Well, breaking news, you disgusting assholes. We all do. The story here in my book is how the rich have once again found a way to screw the poor. Lambiet, who now works as a private detective, said of the Epstein case, "These girls were from 5 or 6 miles away as the crow flies, where the houses are worth $50,000 or $60,000. That's how much one of these people, Jeffrey Epstein and his friends, watches cost. Whole house for $60,000? It shows you the sort of destitution, the poverty that was present in the area and in the neighborhood where Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell went. And West Palm Beach, just across the intracoastal waterway from Palm Beach, has changed as the region has prospered. It has caught some of the spillover as billionaires have pushed millionaires off Palm Beach Island. It is now becoming a hub for hedge funds fleeing New York to take advantage of Florida's low taxes. Goldman Sachs has just leased space. So now what'll happen is these scumbags, hedge funders and the rest, will come in and they'll eat up all the property. It'll shoot up property prices and values. There'll be no gentrification, and they'll simply reap the benefits of the tax structure of Florida. We're seeing it here in East Las Vegas as we speak. The idea is, if you're going to come into one of these areas, you have to gentrify it with your billions of dollars. You're catching all kinds of breaks on the tax end, and here you are just stuffing money in your pockets like the robber barons you are. It is absurd. Still, downbeat pockets remain, as they do in other towns in the vicinity, such as Royal Palm Beach and Loxahatchee, from which many of Epstein's survivors hailed. "I've never seen a divide quite like the one in Palm Beach County," said Jonathan Beaton, who worked as a television reporter in the area for many years. "You can go from heaven to hell in 15 miles. Look, I gotta tell you, that's pretty much par for the course here in Las Vegas, too, like I said in the opening. You can go in Las Vegas, you can be in one neighborhood where there are literally $10, $20 million homes, and a mile away there'll be a homeless camp. But these people are insulated from it, right? They're living in their communities, their gated communities with guards, no access, the whole nine, while the rest of us are just left to suffer. You can also find resentment. When he testified last week, Juan Alessi was still bitter from his dozen years as Epstein's Palm Beach property manager. It was slavery, he said. So, yeah, wouldn't you resent that as well? If you were, working to the bone by Jeffrey Epstein and Maxwell and they're not giving you the proper compensation? Now, don't get it twisted. I'm not a fan of Juan Alessi. I've told you guys that from Jump Street. If this man was really about it, he would have stepped up to the plate back in the day and tried to stop this shit. But he didn't, like the rest of these scoundrels. So He'll never be a good guy, as far as I'm concerned. Maxwell called him John, and instituted house rules that he found degrading. One example, Maxwell forbade him and staff from making eye contact with Epstein. I don't know why you'd want to make eye contact with Epstein anyway. Tell you the truth, gross-ass, ugly son of a bitch. She later reprimanded Alessi in an email to another staffer for doing a truly awful job, after he had allegedly failed to stock pens and bottled water in the black Merc, that is, the Mercedes. So, stop the press, folks. There's no water and there's no pens in the black Mercedes. Well, I wonder if he remembered the gray Poupon. Alessi took his revenge after he quit, returning to the house in 2003 and swiping $6,300 in cash from Epstein. He even admitted under cross-examination. Well, what's he going to do, lie? I think that's kind of going to backfire on the defense as well. No, there's no such thing as a perfect witness, right? And Alessi being somebody who is obviously a pretty scummy, it shouldn't take away from the fact of the testimony as far as what he's seen. Now, certainly it comes down to credibility and reliability and what the jurors are going to feel and believe. So that certainly comes into play. But there's no such thing as a perfect witness. All my life, I worked very hard and saved a lot of money, including the time I worked for Mr. Epstein, he said, attempting to defend his honor. At times, the social gap between Maxwell, daughter of the late British press baron and embezzler Robert Maxwell, and her accusers has seemed unimaginably vast. Again, here's another question to ask yourself. What's Maxwell doing hanging out with all of these girls anyway? All right, let's say in a perfect world, there wasn't all of this evidence against her. Why are you hanging out with girls from downtrodden backgrounds, girls that are from broken homes, and girls that are literally 14 and 15 years old? What possible excuse can you have for that? You don't think the prosecution should ask something like that? It's just, you know, when we look back at this and we take a look in hindsight, I think we're going to see so many missed opportunities by prosecution. While Maxwell flew on the Concorde, was friends with Britain's Prince Andrew, and attended Chelsea Clinton's wedding, one of her accusers, Carolyn, dropped out of middle school in West Palm Beach at 13 and began dating Sean, then 17, who lived across the street. Carolyn had been molested by her grandfather, she told the jury, and her mother was an alcoholic and a drug addict. Now, add to that what Maxwell and Epstein did to her, and you have the perfect storm. Now, for Maxwell's lawyers to go after her the way they did and try and make her feel like she was a piece of shit, reprehensible in my opinion. Of course, that's their job. I get it. Doesn't mean I can't find it reprehensible, because I do. Because I'm an idiot, she quipped, with a kind of lower class fatalism when asked by a prosecutor to explain why she was arrested in 2011 for cocaine possession. Drive around and smoke pot, is how Sean described their relationship. So, because somebody smokes pot, by the way, that makes them a bad person or a liar or somebody who is unreliable? It's a ridiculous line, right? And the whole bringing up the drugs and all of that, it goes right back to their whole entire game plan and their book of tricks from the original prosecution. Carolyn was brought to Epstein by another local teenager, Virginia Roberts, whose father worked in maintenance at Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago Club on Palm Beach. I was young, and $300 was a lot of money to me, Carolyn said of Roberts' offer to earn some cash by helping her massage a rich man in Palm Beach for an hour. Now remember, we're talking about two little girls, okay? The pyramid scheme of human beings that Jeffrey Epstein and Maxwell was running, they'd bring in one girl, in this instance it was Virginia. They'd groom her, normalize her, and then send her out to bring in more friends. Now, mind you, these girls are all little girls when they're doing this. And that was how they had this pyramid scheme running, especially in Palm Beach, for years. And even when somebody ratted them out, even when one of these girls went to the authorities, all Epstein got was the minor slap on the wrist he ended up with. The first time she went to Epstein's house, Carolyn testified, she was greeted by a woman with an English accent who would arrange some of the 100 or so sexualized massages she would give Epstein over the next 2 years. She ended up calling her Maxwell, Carolyn said. Why? The prosecutor asked. Because I couldn't exactly pronounce her first name correctly. Yeah, you and everybody else. When this all first started, I couldn't pronounce her name correctly either. Then again, I'm terrible at pronouncing names. I speak New York Italian, so sometimes the pronunciation is a little bit off, shall we say. Carolyn went on to become a drug addict, a prostitute, and a single mother. In court last week, she was face-to-face with Maxwell, who sat just across from her. At one point, she railed at her, "You broke my soul." Gut-wrenching, folks. It really is gut-wrenching and horrible, all of it. It makes me sad. And the fact that it's the most vulnerable amongst us every single time you turn around is just another reason to want to see these people brought to justice. Now, will they be? That's the definite question we're all asking. We'll have to see what kind of defense Maxwell and her team brings to the table starting Thursday, and if they bring all 35 of those alleged witnesses to the box. Another thing that I doubt's going to happen, but we have to discuss, is will Maxwell take the stand herself? Very interesting question, no doubt about it. As you can see, I uploaded a couple of episodes for some context, a Scott Borgerson episode, some other stuff, and I'll continue to do that throughout the day today, same schedule as we've been on. And tonight I'll be back with a morning, the evening wrap-up, and we'll see where we're at and what we should expect come tomorrow. But for now, folks, that's going to do it. And if you'd like to contact me, you can do that at bobbycappucci@protonmail.com. That's BOBBYCAPUCCI at protonmail.com. You can also find me on Twitter at BOBBY_CAPUCCI. The link that we discussed can be found in the description box.